Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Rice. Japan, in some instances, will put a 700% tariff on rice. So if the United States wants to export rice to Japan, where they eat a lot of rice, Japan will charge a 700% rate on that rice.
U.S. Trade Representative and Ambassador Jamison Greer on the Trump tariffs and how trade is not fair for ag.
It's incredible, right? Ours is much lower. Apples in the United States, if you want to import apples into the United States, it's duty free. It's a 0% tariff. But if we're going to go to, you know, India, it's about 50%. If you want to go to Turkey and send American apples to Turkey, it's a 60% tariff. And so it prevents it. But that's not even the worst part. The worst part are the non-tariff barriers where they use fake science or fake standards or other barriers to keep out our things.
This is Agriculture Today.
At the end of the day, one friend in Indiana told me years ago, which I subscribe to, hogs trade like they ice skate. So the hogs can be a very, very difficult day trade.
Chris Robinson is with Robinson Ag Marketing in Chicago.
If you look at where the hogs are, though, here, I'm looking at May spot hogs. You know, right here at this 88.5, 90 cent area, we're really in the middle of a trading range, which we've been stuck at for about 2 weeks here now. So I think where we settle on Friday is going to be very important. I think if we can get May back above 90 cents, that's going to take some of the pressure off. The one good thing we've got, Tony, is the managed money. They are still bet long the entire protein complex, cattle, live cattle, feeder cattle, and lean hogs. You're right, though. This could be like a blow-off area where if somebody gets stuck in the stock market and they feel like they can't sell enough S&P, they tend to come in and sell the protein complex. Doesn't always happen that way. It's not an absolute law of physics or anything, but that's one thing I'd be worried about here if I was long anything in the protein complex. Lean hogs have had a good recovery. At the end of the day, the hog market is, cattle and pig report came out. There's not the size herd that we normally would like to see. But the big what if is obviously what happens with China. But if you look at the last 5 years, I wanted to get up real quick. It's been a tremendous rally in fat cattle and feeder cattle since the COVID lows. Up 150%, 158% if you did the math. I ran it today. So even though the stock market's under pressure here and, you know, we had some pressure in the cattle today, big picture, it's still been a tremendous explosion higher in prices over the last 5 years. We have not had a really serious long-term correction. We've had tiny ones, but I still think that if you're a producer, you know, it's always good to be, if you're going to have a correction, let's have it off these all-time highs. Earlier this morning, it looked like the market was going to completely shrug it off. It didn't even care about what was going on in the S&P and the Dow Jones, but that's a positive. The only thing I'd worry about to the flip side is the fact that the investment community is bet very, very long. They've got record positions nearly in feeder cattle. That means they own quite a bit of contracts there. And the risk is that if something was to really get out of hand with a bigger correction in the stock market, something past 10% or 15%, that could be pressure. So it's a really good time to look into hedges whenever you're at all-time highs. Not hedging cattle here at $2 and the fats out in October and $2.88 in September. Not hedging there. It would be kind of like if we had $16 beans and you're like, yeah, I don't really care about hedging it. Or if we had $8 corn or $7.50 corn. Sooner or later, we're going to correct, Tony. So the one positive I could say is it's a great opportunity to go get some hedges out there now, because with all hedges, especially if you're protecting the downside, they are always the cheapest before the correction. What you don't want to do is wait till we have a 10 or 15 or 20 cent, 100 weight break, and then be like, wow, I guess I should have hedged. So take advantage of it. Get a hedge on. Sit back, and we'll see how it all unfolds. But we are dancing around contract highs in the live cattle, and you've got lean hogs hanging in there, relatively speaking. And if you are concerned about, the what if we really have a down move in prices, you got to get your hedge on before we have the break.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Well, I think it's important because our overall goal is it's farm value and long-term profitability. And sometimes we have goals of passing farms to generations beneath us.
Dr. Corey Walters is an associate professor of ag economics, University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
But we have a short-term goal of paying our bills. So we have two competing goals, and one of them is cash flow. I got to be able to pay my bills maybe today, but a longer-term goal of I want to increase the value of the farm business. And sometimes those things work against each other.
But when we talk opportunity cost, are all investments considered that?
Investing in the stock market might be an inappropriate opportunity cost, because if you really have no interest in investing in a financial asset like the stock market, it's just not appropriate. A better approximation might be just land rent. How much could this land be rented for if I were choosing not to operate myself? So there has to be an appropriate opportunity cost that is chosen. The stock market is a little bit flashier to point out that, you know what, we have millions of dollars of assets under control. We should make a lot of money. I'm not very shy about telling my students that if they don't have a goal for their home, farm, or ranch, I'll give them one. And it's to make a lot of money so that they have to donate it back to my department. and it's, you know, we laugh about it, but there's a lot of risk. There's a lot of hard work. There's a lot of skill. And the economy is supposed to reward people that are taking on those risks and producing in the highest and best way possible.
When it comes to cash flow, profitability, and solvency.
Well, first of all, write everything down. It is a little bit surprising how sometimes we don't know what we have. So that's important to be able to understand the difference in profitability in our different enterprises, not just what we're producing, but also where we're producing. So if we have owned ground, how does that cash flow and profit compared to rented ground, and being able to discern the difference between those two? That would certainly be a place that people can start. The example in the article, the producer has a giant pile of money. And when he takes on a new quarter section of ground, it doesn't cash flow when he's borrowing the money. And we can see his cash balance going down. But the liquidated value of his farm, which would mean I sell all the assets and pay off all the debt, actually goes up because the operations on the new quarter section of ground are profitable. Owner's equity reflects that, but the cash balance doesn't. If you don't have a giant pile of money, you have to be able to realize that you are growing the value of the farm business while your cash balance is going down. Maybe a better way to think about it would be an operator that is gifted a new equipment line, gifted nice farmland, but then just does a poor job operating. They make poor decisions that just from a production standpoint are not necessarily doing a great job, but they're okay. That's going to cash flow because they own all of their equipment. They own all of their land. They don't have any interest expense. They're going to have money left over at the end of the year. When that equipment needs to be replaced, they might be in a world of hurt. So that highlights the paradox in the other way, where the operator might be actually producing at a loss, but their cash flow is positive. In the short run, cash flow and profit are not the same thing. Over a longer period of time, and it doesn't have to be that long, they do reconcile. We just don't want operators to have bad surprises.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The border closure due to New World screwworm back at Thanksgiving took quite a bit of time and effort to resolve.
Ethan Lane is Senior Vice President of Government Affairs with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
We're now operating under a protocol negotiated between the U.S. government and the Mexican government to ensure that cattle that are crossing the border into the United States receive pretty vigorous oversight to ensure that we're not bringing New World screwworm into the United States on the backs of those cattle. That is something that all credit goes to the Trump administration. In his first week in office, we called the White House and said, hey, we need help with this. We called USDA and said, hey, we need help. And they answered that call. They got that negotiation across the finish line. I believe something on the order of 60,000 or 65,000 head has crossed since that time. So pretty dramatically reduced flow of cattle, but cattle are moving. And you know, that system is doing what it's supposed to do, which is keep New World's crewworm at bay while we find a more comprehensive solution. I working with Congress and the administration to put some tools in place to push that pest back down into Central America and keep it away from U.S. borders. But yeah, for sure, that does throttle that supply. You know, on an average year, about 4%, give or take, 4.3%, I think, of feeder cattle in the U.S. system are coming from across the border. Those are typically seasonal in nature. And, you know, what we've talked about is that, you know, when we talk about the USMCA, we talk about the Mexican and the Canadian and North American supply chain. And this isn't meant to be derogatory to our friends in Mexico or Canada at all, but the way our system is designed, we have producers that are really using both sides of that border as sort of excess capacity. We have a lot of calves, 500,000 calves on the East Coast get shipped to Canada. They're fed out in Canada and then they're brought back down into the United States to be processed at U.S. processing facilities. We have a lot of back and forth, much like many other industries that have been sort of built around, those border structures from originally NAFTA and now USMCA. So, you know, working through these challenges is a constant kind of discussion with our trading partners to the north and south, the Canadian cattlemen, the Mexican cattlemen. And that's a dialogue that's ongoing. But, to be sure, as far as supply goes, I don't know that we can imagine any more headwinds. You know, you still have drought conditions in many parts of the country. Money is still very expensive. Inputs, although they've come down some, are still a tremendous pressure point. You add escalating land values and the uncertainty of the tax landscape until Congress is able to renew the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act package. And there's a lot of pressure on producers that's really disincentivizing them from doubling up their herd or going through an expansion, even though they can all see that money sitting there right now in this supply chain. We're watching all those things. We're engaging everywhere we can and trying to relieve that pressure.
Another issue the Mexican industry is facing, drought. Dr. Darrell Pill, Oklahoma State Livestock Marketing Economist.
The drought right now is confined to northern and northwestern Mexico, which is a pretty big cattle area. But in 2023, there was drought pretty widespread across the country. It did improve in central Mexico quite a bit in 2024. So some of the cattle out of northern Mexico the last few months have been relocating farther south into the country, gives them a little bit of a place to go. But when that border closed, the backlog of feeder cattle that happened initially really kind of flooded the Mexican market. And so there's a pretty big value difference now between Mexican prices and U.S. prices, whereas typically they kind of, they sort of come together based on transportation and other factors to explain the difference in those prices.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Well, I'd say 65 is a big level.
Talking crude oil. Chris Robinson, Robinson Ag Marketing in Chicago.
You got to remember, the day before we had the election, or the day before it was inaugurated, we had $80 a barrel oil. Right? Oil had gone from 65 to 80 for a variety of reasons. I'm not going to get too far in the woods, but crude oil moves, in $15, $20 cracks right now. And you saw it here with this correction. You're correct. We were just at 72 bucks yesterday, and we dropped down to, just north of 66. And that's the way it works. It took a month to rally $7, and it took 12 hours to lose basically that entire amount. So, again, now what's the silver lining to this, Tony? It's got to be the fact that it's made the the break in crude oil has also pulled down diesel. Diesel just creeping up on 235. We were at 233.5, and we finished today now at 218. If we see diesel drop below 215, that's going to be a gift to anybody that hasn't filled up their tanks yet. So, the way these markets move, you're absolutely right. We could be, crude oil could be back up at 75 bucks next week. But boy, when you get a break like this, if you are in need of covering your inputs, and most guys are getting ready in the next week or two here to get out there and start doing field work, take advantage of this break. And if you need to buy diesel, it got a heck of a lot cheaper than it was just yesterday.
What about soy meal?
So Emil, it's funny. It feels like we went down there and we did get some good exports yesterday. Not surprisingly, because we are contract lows. That contract has been under pressure. But I'm concerned how we settle on Friday. Bean oil and canola oil have both had pretty good recoveries. Now, granted, we were lower today with the action we had in the crude market. The crude market had a $7 drop in 24 hours. But even that has kind of stabilized a little bit. So meal, at the end of the day, I think is a buyer's market. This is not the time I would be getting super bearish with meal, really on these multi-year lows. We're due for recovery, and you're starting to see, just like we saw yesterday, some better demand coming in. So end users are noticing that it's on sale. And despite the issues with the tariffs and the concerns about what's going to happen with those, if somebody sees a market like soybean meal that's on sale, they're going to step in and buy it. And anywhere that anybody needs to feed livestock, this is an opportunity for them. So I'm hopeful that we can carve out a bottom here. But again, I'm real concerned how we settle on the week. But a good recovery. We'll see if we can get more good demand. And we won't really get that demand information until Monday of next week.
Then there's the equities, i.e. stock market.
For the last really 6-7 months, we've been in a 5,000-point trading range as a Dow. So I guess the good news is we have not made new lows yet in the Dow. By new lows, I mean we have not taken out the low that we had in the middle of March about 3 weeks ago. So glass half full. We still haven't had bigger than a 10% correction in the Dow. Most people look at 20% as a bear market. So, if this is the worst we can do, maybe we're dodging a bullet. I'm always trying to look at the positive side of things. The S&P is at about a 10.5% correction. So I'd say that while people are, obviously pointing out the fact that we're sharply lower, on a percentage basis, it could be a lot worse. I'll just leave it at that. How's that? So glass half full.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Anyone who has followed Donald Trump's career knows that this has been a closely held belief of him his entire professional career. He was talking about tariffs in the early 80s.
Ethan Lane, Senior Vice President, Government Affairs, National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
This man believes in this as a tool to his core, and he said repeatedly on the campaign trail this is what he was going to do. We all have expected it. We knew this was going to be a feature of this administration. So this day shouldn't be surprising to anyone in this conversation. But from the U.S. cattle industry's perspective, I think this presents an opportunity for us to work with the administration on some of these trade relationships internationally that, quite frankly, have not been equitable for U.S. cattle producers for a very long time. Now, we have a lot of trade relationships that are equitable, great trade relationships. Our relationship with Japan, South Korea, there are a lot of countries we have great relationships with. They like our product. They allow us access. Their consumers enjoy what we send. It works for our supply chain. But there are some others where we have seen both tariff barriers, traditional tariff barriers, as well as the president mentioned non-tariff trade barriers, for decades now erected to stop USB from entering various markets around the world. And, the president looking at these different parts of the economy and trying to see where, some tariff activity could incentivize those governments to come to the table and discuss a more equitable trade relationship with U.S. Industries is an opportunity we want to make sure we're helping the president with and taking advantage of to ensure that our producers around the country get the best deal possible when exporting our product around the world.
And at the Rose Garden on Wednesday, Trump outlining those tariffs.
We were pleased to have been invited to the Rose Garden yesterday to attend this event with the president. We had some of the Iowa cattlemen in town. They were in town for meetings, so they were able to go along with me over to that event. And, it was a great opportunity to be there and see something like that in person, but it was extremely gratifying to hear the president make mention of U.S. beef, make mention of the unfair treatment we've received from the Australians, and the fact that that's on his plate and something he's going to take on and hopefully help us with. That's all we can ask for in this kind of situation. And you know, our job then is to make sure we're continuing to inform the president and his staff of the details and the needs of our producers around the country to make sure he's armed with all the information he needs to negotiate with those foreign governments and get us those deals that we need. So, I think his comments have certainly, sent the Australians into a tizzy. The prime minister was talking about us overnight. And, certainly we've seen a lot of articles talking about this in the last few days. So we've certainly captured their attention. And that's a big market for them shipping into the United States. So they have a lot to lose here. If they play this wrong or are too cavalier about it. So, it was great to be on hand to watch that and now participate in the conversations moving forward.
What do cattlemen want from this administration?
We don't love tariffs. We would love no tariffs so that we could just compete, because when we compete with the high quality product that our producers raise, we win. Everywhere we go in the world, we raise better beef than anyone else on planet Earth. And when we're allowed to compete, we win. So that's all we're asking for here is the opportunity to compete in those markets. And we're hopeful that the president can use this tool to get us that access. And hopefully the end result of this will be that these tariffs won't be necessary because the countries can find some common ground, lower those tariff rates down and allow access in a way that allows us to continue really asserting ourselves in those foreign markets and driving profitability for producers.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
So 45Z, from a biofuels policy standpoint, we all need to remember it was part of the Inflation Reduction Act of 2021-22 from a crop year perspective.
You might have heard the term 45Z, but what does it mean? Brian Burke is president of JSA. Recently in Nashville, explaining.
And the whole intention behind that is to continue to develop greener supply chains within the energy segment. So it's not necessarily about the destination product. It's also about how do we pull through greener practices in the energy space, resulting in renewable diesel or biodiesel or ethanol or sustainable aviation fuel that pulls in a chain of greener practices all the way to the producer. We had the climate smart farming pieces of that as well. 45Z is a component of that. There's different time series of different regulations that the IRA put into effect. With the changing of administrations right before Biden left, we have a rules clarifying process or a rules proposal that was made that has a comment period that we're actually in the middle of right now. The challenge we have is the comment period on these proposed rules and carbon credits and all of those that can be a result of how these rules are put in place also came with an administrative change. So that administrative change was dramatic. A new EPA secretary, a new president with very different views. So I'm referring to it as sand in the gears. We have a proposed rule about climate smart farming for the producer, and it lays out various practices. Those rules can be interpreted different by the new EPA secretary versus the one that Biden had that just left office. So there's room for interpretation in here, even though there's some headlines that have come across like, you know, completely getting rid of the IRA. And those are a little bit too aggressive. But we can certainly see sand in the gears, and we've certainly seen capital take a pause in the marketplace versus the last few years until we get a better handle.
So 45Z appears to benefit producers of biofuels. What about farmers?
The intention of 45Z and it being implemented in a way I think as intended certainly has value throughout the entire chain, all the way through to the farmer. So when I think of capital investment, we think of carbon sequestration wells, we think of CO2 pipelines, and that's a whole different element altogether depending on where you're at. But it's the decarbonization of the value chain. And are there things that producers can do and that the industry has been preparing for to bring, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 cents a bushel in certain farm practices, certain types of soil, certain cover crops, certain fertilizer application practices? All of those things are in this rule proposing process, and that's where capital will move to with clarity. And that's really where we're struggling, is on that clarity piece. I think there's a lot of foundation there for this to run. It's just, again, that sand in the gears clarity of before I deploy this next several million dollars of capital to bring this system or bring this greener application to my processing facility to become qualified for SAF as a feedstock, I need to have some certainty before I deploy that capital. But it runs the entire gamut of the value chain.
Brian Burke, president of JSA. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The original sin was that we created a tax system that punished you for making something in America and rewarded you for making something in China or a foreign country. So in other words, if you had your factory in America, you paid a sky-high corporate tax rate, you were beaten to death with regulation, you had radically unaffordable energy prices, and Washington just in every way made your life miserable.
Stephen Miller is deputy chief of staff at the White House on the Trump tariffs.
Everyone in the world knows if I want to sell to America, just move your factory to America. Nothing is clearer, more stable, more predictable than that. You want to sell to Americans, then get your company, get your business, get your plant, and move it to America. That is the most predictable. And on top of that, we're going to have regulatory certainty, tax certainty, and energy certainty. So this is the definition of certainty and predictability. And to your point, it's not a short-term fix. It's the total realignment of the global trade system to put America first.